Blog Talk Radio.
Paperback Writer.
This is the Writer's Lounge, where we showcase new authors. This is show number 91. The date is March 22nd, 2021, and I am your host, Tom Rydell. A brief intro to today's show. We're having on author Kristen McKiernan, who wrote Sunder of Time. It's a time travel story, and I just love time travel stories. Before we get to her, we're going to talk to you a little bit about the show and more. What's more about us here on the Writer's Lounge. Here's where you can find us out there. Find us on Facebook, of course, the Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. Find the book reviews of all of our current shows over at thomasrydell.net. I will spell that for you because it's kind of hard to spell the last name. It's T-H-O-M-A-S. RIDDELL.net. And on the on-demand shows, you can find them over on the Blog Talk Radio site and just search for the Writer's Lounge, and there you will find us over there on the Blog Talk Radio site. You can also find me on Twitter at TomRydell56, and our email is writerslounge2020@yahoo.com. If you want to be on the show and have your book reviewed, put guest request in the subject line and we'll get back to you. Right now we do have openings, but the openings are filling up pretty quickly here, and it looks like we're already into May. So April is already filled up. And May, I believe, the end of May is opening up. So if you want to get in, go ahead and email us again at writerslounge2020@yahoo.com. A special note, I'm excited about this. We can also now be heard on your Alexa device. Subscribe to TuneIn and ask her to play the Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. I'd also like to put in a plug for Readsy Discovery. I do a lot to help authors and readers alike, and I also review books over there as well. And that would wrap up the intro to the show. And right now, let's get into writers' topics. four writers' topics this week. I'm going to discuss what it's like to write historical fiction. And to do this, I'd like to touch on something that has been close and very personal to me for the last 30 years. Making a long story short, I started doing research on something shocking that I found out from my grandmother when I was 18 years old. My grandfather was a very beloved man, and I could never imagine him as anything but kind, joyful, and humorous. Simply, he was my pop. I called him Pop because he wasn't only just my pop, he was my adopted father, and my grandmother was my adopted mother. They took me in when I was 6 months old after my mother and father split up and went their separate ways. Well, anyway, back to the shocking news. One day I was in my room and I heard my grandmother and grandfather having a bit of an argument out in the living room. And I heard my grandmother say to Pop, "Russell, if you don't cut it out, you're going to get bread and water like you used to get." Well, if you know anything about old prison stories, you know that bread and water was one of the meals that they used to serve inmates. My grandfather left the apartment, and I went out to ask my grandmother what she meant. She was in tears. She sat me down and told me that your grandfather had a very dark past. She didn't know all the details, but she did tell me that Pop had once met Al Capone. This was in 1975, and she told me this about my grandfather. Pop died in 1979. My grandmother died in 1988. It wasn't until 1993, on a lazy, rainy day, after browsing the New York Times index files in the local library, that I began to uncover over 50 stories on my grandfather's misdeeds, or dark days, as my grandmother called them. My grandfather was involved in numerous bootlegging crimes, as well as being the main suspect in the killing of a business partner and bootlegger king. The authorities fingered him for that crime, but he did close to 30 years in Sing Sing prison for unrelated crimes. It's a story that I finally compiled into a book that was just published last September. Poppy's Prison is the name of the book, and it's based on true events, which are included in the book in the form of the news articles. I filled in the story around those true events with fictional tales that I felt came close to the true narrative of the story, and I had to do extensive research on all the characters mentioned. And I have to tell you, it was difficult, but at the same time, it was a very rewarding experience. It's only my first historical fiction effort, but I'd like to give you five helpful tips and comments if you plan on writing historical fiction. Number one on the list is don't rush it. It was over 30 years in the making for me, but when I first started to actually write it, it took me about a year and a half to complete. In order to get the time period correct, in my case, it was the 1920s, there's a lot of research to do, but have fun with it. I learned so much extra that wasn't even in the book. Number two, if there's any movies out there on the period you're researching, watch them. You can pick up a lot on the dialect of speech, period clothing and transportation methods, and so much more. Number three, keep an organized notebook and use resources like newspapers.com, ancestry.com, and Google Earth. It was a great help to me when researching out old addresses and seeing the old buildings that are still standing today. Number four, don't get so caught up in your characters and the plot that you forget the major events of the time you are writing about, like the wars, sporting events, political events, and weather events also. It'll help to give your characters depth and meaning and focus on what their concerns were other than what was happening in their immediate lives. Number five, the best thing about writing historical fiction is learning more about the time period and people even after you've typed the last word of your story. And go back to it to see if you can expand on the story in another book. It's addicting once you start writing historical fiction. If you want to purchase a copy of Hoppy's Prison, you can find that over at my website, thomasrydell.net, or search for it on Kindle or other e-reader device. So whatever you are writing, I encourage you to continue and above all, have fun and take an interest in your characters in the time period that they're living in. After all, you've created them and their world is also your world to explore even after you've written that last word. Okay, and with that, now comes the main event. As I said at the top of the show, we have today with us Kristen McTiernan, who wrote Sunder of Time, and this is the book, Sunder of Time, and this is my review on Sunder of Time. I have dreamed of and thought about time travel for as long as I can remember. To try and understand Albert Einstein's theory of special relativity has been a bit difficult for me to absorb, so I relied on movies like Star Trek and Back to the Future to help break down the science and bring me the adventures of time travel through fiction. It's a genre of literary fiction that appeals to a lot of readers, and so when I found McTiernan's efforts on writing a time travel saga, I was immediately drawn to Sunder of Time. I was not disappointed. The main character, Isabella Jaramillo, was interesting and likable from the beginning of this story. In addition, the author's use of plot conflict was numerous but very well placed to give the tale substance and thought-provoking scenarios. If time travel is actually possible, McTiernan did a good job of explaining the complexities and dangers that a people in a society would have to consider before sending anyone through time. The author should also be given credit for her knowledge of history, especially for endeavoring to send Isabella back to the Dark Ages. This is a rich and interesting tale told about time travel, but it's also a story about love, family, and decisions that will have to be made to save or not to save history as we know it. This book is a top shelf winner. I look forward to the next book in this series. And now it is my pleasure to welcome Kristen McTiernan to the Writer's Lounge. And with a little touch of the button on the switchboard, I should have her here. Kristen, are you there?
I am, Tom. How are you?
Very good. How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful.
Are you enjoying the second day of spring?
I actually am. Our winter here in Kansas City was pretty gnarly. We got that nasty 2-week sub-zero cold snap, so I'm definitely enjoying the springtime weather.
Yes, I remember that. All the way down to Texas, they had some horrible weather, and I'm so happy that, well, most people made it through that, but there's a few unlucky ones who didn't. But glad to have you on the show, and I've been doing a little bit of research on you. I've seen some of your YouTube videos, and I've seen your author profile on Amazon. You've authored at least 8 books already, and you've had quite an interesting life so far. Can you tell our listeners about who you are and what or who inspired you to write and to become an author?
Well, sure. You know, I started off like a lot of writers. You know, I just loved to write as a kid. But then, you know, when I was trying to figure out what to do with my life, I wasn't really thinking at first about becoming a writer. I was torn between joining a Catholic convent and joining the military. I come from a military family, and so service has always kind of been a part of our existence, but I felt called to live kind of a nun's life. But lucky for me, the Mother Superior at the convent I was planning on joining was a veteran herself. And she said, look, you're 17 years old. You've never been out of your dad's house. Go ahead and enlist. And when you're done with your enlistment, we're still going to be here. So give yourself some time to be out in the world and figure out what you want. And boy, was that great advice, because if I'd have gone straight from high school to the convent, I think maybe I'd have regretted that decision.
Yes,
so, yeah, I served only 2.5 years in the Marines, actually. I got injured, and because 9/11 had just happened, honestly, they didn't have a lot of time to kind of fiddle around with somebody who was injured. So I got an honorable discharge, and I went to college and majored in English. And it was there that I was like, you know, I really like to write, and I like to write fiction, and I like to hear about history, and I want to write a novel. And while I was in there, you know, when you major in English, you have to, you know, take a lot of background courses. And one of them was history of the English language, which they go all the way back to Anglo-Saxon times. And you get to see how what we now call English developed out of, you know, ancient Saxon. And then it changed when different ethnic groups came. And then, of course, you know, the Norman conquest ultimately started to change it into what we know today. But while I was doing that, I was like, wow, well, so all those movies where people travel back in time to ancient England and they speak English in a perfect British accent, that's not accurate at all. And if we right. had traveled back, we wouldn't be able to understand a word they said. And that was kind of the spark for Sunder of Time way back in 2006.
Now, who inspired you to write?
To write in general, I didn't really have anybody to inspire me. I would say to write well and add details and write with richness, I would say that it was my history of the English language teacher, Dr. Mel Storm, who I actually name check within the Sunder series. In the third book, I put his name in there as a fictional character. And he was just a very methodical man and, you know, not a very effusive speaker, but he always spoke with such measure and wanted to get the details exactly right. And you could tell he really had a passion for these ancient figures like Old King Canute and, you know, just these ancient Saxon characters. It was just like, wow, that's awesome. And it was just his quiet passion that really inspired me to be like, okay, I'm going to be serious about this writing and not just dash something off.
Yeah, they say that when you read books, it should be like somebody dropped you right into the scene where the characters are. And when I read Sunder in Time, I felt like I had gone back to the Dark Ages, and you did a marvelous job of depicting the era, which I have hardly read nothing about, a little bit here and there through my life. But it was amazing how you were able to bring me into that time frame of history. It was really amazing. I imagine too also that you probably have a nun story in your repertoire somewhere to write maybe in the future, huh?
I'm actually working on one right now, and it's I'm planning on it being just like a short story, maybe to give away for free for my other series, which is a more modern kind of paranormal trilogy. And one of my characters is basically going to join a convent to kind of hide away from trauma. And so I'm going to, you know, dive into that. And it's the kind of convent that I would have joined, which was, you know, full habit, Latin mass, very cloistered. And so, yeah, it's not going to be a full length work, but I think it'll be fun to write.
Right. In Sunder of Time, time travel is a theme, of course, that drives the story. What are your understandings of time travel? And do you think we'll ever be able to do what Isabel did?
It's hard to say. I'm not a science geek, but from the reading that I did, I don't think that we will be able to time travel, because obviously string theory is the biggest theory right now, where we just kind of all bump up against each other. So in that, it would be very difficult to create a machine that would allow us to traverse that. Which is a shame. I think it would be fun, you know, barring the consequences of time travel. But of course, you know, if we look at Avengers Endgame, where you can travel back in time and it creates kind of a splinter time where it doesn't really affect
yes.
things, like you're not undoing things like that, that would be very interesting as well. I was really fascinated with how they did time travel because it was so unique and so much different than what other, you know, movies and books did.
Somebody explained it to me like two pieces of paper. One is our line, our time that we're familiar with, and if you were to time travel, you could go back into a time, but it would be like another sheet of paper underneath it, where you couldn't actually, for instance, go back and, as they often talk about, you couldn't possibly kill your grandfather. That would be impossible because you're on a different sort of, you know, time, like you say, splintered. I think that's a very interesting concept, but I've always, since a child, been interested in time travel and imagine myself being able to go back and change history. It's very, very interesting. And of course, there's a genre out there that is loaded with time travel stories, and I just love every one of them that I can get my hands on. That's why I went to your story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it. And, you know, it's funny how things rise and fall with the trends. So time travel's kind of been on the wane lately, except in the hardest of sci-fi genres. So I was like, well, I'm more of a soft sci-fi person. I do like if there's science involved. Like, I did not care for Outlander. Oh, if you just touch a rock, you can go back in time. I don't care for that. But I also don't care for, like, the super nitty-gritty pages and pages of science. I just kind of skip through that. So I was trying to strike a balance with my writing, where there's just enough science for it to be science fiction-y, but not so much where it would make, you know, people's eyes glaze over.
Right. Talk to us about Isabella. What was it like to create her and the other characters in your story? And is there any of you in her character?
I would hope not, at least not at first. Isabella Jaramillo is just your princess. And she's very sure that she deserves everything that she was born into, and she really doesn't give a whole lot of thought to other human beings and the fact that they might have feelings and want things that are contrary to what she wants. You know, she's never had to deal with that. And that's part of the world that she's in. You know, they're in a strict Catholic theocracy, and it's very hierarchical. You know, you're categorized. You know, if you're of Spanish descent, then you're of, you know, the good class. You know, you're better than people who are of French ancestry, or God forbid, if you're of Anglo ancestry. They just kind of dice themselves into groups and place heavy value on that, which has created a caste system that Isabella is at the top of. And then because her father basically invented the time travel industry as they know it, of course, she's famous. She's basically America's princess, even though they don't have, you know, royalty. So with that in mind, when she's catapulted into the past by her vindictive, you know, what she wanted to be her ex-husband, she just doesn't know how to handle that. She's never experienced any kind of, you know, people telling her no or having an idea. And she gets such a rude awakening when she's confronted with Dark Ages men who mostly don't speak her language. You know, she's able to communicate through Latin, but not everybody speaks Latin, only the nobility do. And they're certainly not going to put up with her attitude. And so it's just kind of a humbling when she first gets there.
And how did you create her? Did she just come to you in your head, or did you sit down and give it some thought? Those things sometimes happen to us late.
The trials that she went through upon arriving kind of just came to me immediately, but having her start off as being so unpleasant, that came over time because, you know, as I presented early drafts in my writing group, there was, you know, a lot of new writers are afflicted with this. There's no growth in the character. They start off as a good person, and then they finish as a good person, but they learned along the way. You know, that can be rather boring, actually. And so they were like, look, you know, there's not much of a character arc here. So let's have her not start off as such a good person. And so I tweaked it, and I didn't want to make her, like, you know, overtly awful where she's like a war criminal or something. So I was like, well, I'll just make her just a clueless rich girl who just doesn't care about people. And that really seemed to hit it off, because I think we've all met those people who just don't see other human beings, and they're not necessarily all wealthy either, which is sad. And so that really seemed to work, because, you know, we've all met that person.
Right. So not a spoiler, only kind of a teaser, but the way you ended with her was wonderful, I thought. And that was a good indication that your character was developed, because I really liked it. I liked the ending very much. And let's see here. Before we get on with the next question, I'd like to let everybody else out there. We've got a lot of shy people, so I'm not sure if you're going to actually call in, but you can call in live to the show here at area code 914-219-0868 and talk to Kristen or myself regarding Sunder in Time. And Kristen, of the books you've written so far, what is your favorite and why?
Oh, that's a tough one. Honestly, I would say that Fissure of Worlds, which is the sequel to Sunder of Time, I think that's still my favorite, because I was able to build upon the world of Sunder of Time, but mostly moving on to almost an entirely new cast of characters, and mostly expanding upon the world of, you know, future Miami. And I really liked the villain that I created, and that he wasn't like, you know, the mustache twirler. He was very complicated, and some of them, particularly my male readers, really liked him. And even though they understood he's villainous and he needs to be taken down, they were still like, I kind of hope he lives through the end of the third. Like, they were really kind of hoping that. So I thought I did a good job. And then also just the dynamics of people. One thing that I can't stand about what writers do nowadays is they'll write someone who is very meek and mild and kind, and then when the plot requires it, they just bust out with these, you know, badass fight moves, and they're vicious, and, you know, they win the day. And I'm like, generally speaking, nice, kind, gentle people don't just bust out with lethal martial arts moves. And
right.
That's something that movies and books are so guilty of these days, and it bothers me. And so I created my villain, you know, who's physically fit and aggressive. And then I, as a counterpoint, you know, I created another male character who is kind. And when he overcomes things, he doesn't do it through those means. He finds other ways. Sorry.
So there was, yeah, go ahead.
I really liked the characters in the book, and the plot seemed to flow very organically. So yeah, I was very happy with that one.
In putting your story together, there's software out there now that I find very interesting. In fact, I just downloaded it for myself. It's called Campfire. Are you familiar with it?
No, I've never heard it.
It's it's story Bible. It's to develop your characters, and they allow you to world build in it. And it's a fabulous piece of software. It's getting a lot of good reviews. And once again, it's called Campfire, but have a check with that if you get a chance. It's a very minimal cost, and I think it's really good for keeping everything together, because I'm into a 90,000-word novel myself, and it's kind of hard to remember where everybody fits in and what their characters are like and where they're at in the story as far as, you know, maps and all that stuff. So I just thought I'd throw that in there. It's probably a little advertisement or a plug, but I was wondering if you used any kind of software like that to keep track of your stories.
I actually use OneNote for pretty much everything. You know, I have a series Bible for both of my series. And sometimes when I need them, you know, I'll put in, you know, pictures of public figures who I think are a fair approximation of the character and descriptions, and then of course, you know, where they ended up in the last book that I wrote. So when I pick up for the next one, it's all right there. So yeah, I love OneNote. I'm big into the Microsoft suite. I'm not a Mac person.
Right.
So I've had great success with that, and I can keep track of all of my documents and notes. And, you know, you mentioned YouTube. It helps for my YouTube videos and for courses that I've got going on as well.
Right. How important is research in your writing, and where do you mainly go for those resources?
Oh, it's very important, especially for Sunder of Time. There were actually, you know, there was some stuff available on the internet, but because of, you know, the Dark Ages is not a particularly popular time period. So if you're looking into Edwardian England, or if you're looking to, you know, the Glorious Revolution, which, you know, the third book takes place in, there's a lot more online, and there's characters and descriptions of those historical figures, and there's motion pictures made about them, but there's not a lot with the Dark Ages. So honestly, at the time I was living in Las Vegas, most of my research came down to going to UNLV library. I had to sit there, and a lot of the stuff I couldn't even check out because they were, you know, historical documents or they were reference documents. So I had to sit there in the library, and I had to read, okay, how did they get arrows out of people's shoulders back in that time? What did tanners do? How exactly was war performed? And it was the university library that was really helpful because people had written dissertations or there were visual approximations that people, you know, kept on file of actual places like Shaftesbury. And so, yeah, I was very, very helped by the UNLV library.
How did they get arrows out of shoulders back in those ages?
Well, what they had to do was they had to soak a rag full of turpentine and stick it into the wound and then push the arrow through because they couldn't pull it out. And then they would have the rag soaked in turpentine go after it to disinfect it.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. sounds just awful.
See, that gives you a good taste of what her book, Thunder and Time, is about. And I found it so so interesting, and I think I probably learned a lot about those times from reading your book. It was amazing what they how they lived, and you know, imagine living in a dwelling with no heat and running water or showers or any of that stuff that we enjoy today. And it's amazing. Like I say, a big part I think your book was to take Isabella, who's a modern woman, and to put her back into that time. And her ex-husband did that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, that was kind of a teaching moment, too. It's like, you know, you can only push people so far before they push back.
Right. Where is your favorite place to go to write? Excuse me.
You know, it depends. Sometimes I'm happy just being outside. Like if I'm writing by hand, you know, for some reason being outside is helpful. But barring that, because the weather doesn't always cooperate, I actually write quite a bit at Panera. The one that's nearest to me has this nice big bank of windows with booths up all the side of them. And you can just sit there and write and, you know, barring any boisterous teenagers, which isn't terribly frequent. You know, you can write for hours and it's fantastic.
Well, do you people watch when you're out there?
I don't. I tend to try and stay very focused. And then, you know, when, you know, because I can write in spurts, I think most people do. And, you know, when I hit the, okay, that's enough for now, usually, you know, no more than 20 minutes at a time, then I just kind of, you know, zone out and, you know, scroll and then write. Go back to it. I typically don't people watch very much. I don't want to be that weird person staring at people.
Right. How do you handle book reviews? It's been very difficult for me, and I know some other authors on the show have expressed their feelings about book reviews. How do you deal with it?
I don't generally get mad. The only time I've ever gotten mad is when somebody seems to dislike a book for a stupid reason. So for the Black Magic series, I had someone give me a 2-star review because he said that my book was fat phobic. And I said, what in the world are you talking about? Like my heroine is plus size, you know, I didn't specify what size she is, but you know, she's a normal woman, probably around a size 14. Her girlfriend is also plus size. And I'm like, where are you getting fat phobic? Is it because, you know, she made a point of saying, oh, my mom tried to deny me sweets when I was a kid, but hey, mom, joke's on you, I got fat anyway, you know, but it was a lighthearted thing. And I'm like, how are you going to take that small thing and pretend that my book has a prejudice against people that I'm elevating, you know, as a major character? So I got irritated with that one. But most of the time, you know, not all books are for all people. So if somebody gives me a 3 stars and it's like, eh, you know, it was okay. You know, I take that as, okay, well, that's not my ideal reader. And that's cool.
Right.
Cause there's a lot of books that are New York Times bestsellers that I just didn't care for. And,
right.
You know.
Yeah. And that's good. I know that I had somebody on last show who expressed that she would like to get a 3-star review. She's gotten all 5-star reviews. She's a new author. but you would like to mix it up a little bit and get a 3-star review. And I feel the same way. I don't want I don't want it to appear that I had gone out and had mom and dad review my books. I want some, you know, I want some diversity in there. And I know, like you said, books, some stories aren't for everybody. There's different stories of people like, and some of them they just don't like. What I don't like is when they'll give you a 1-star review and they probably haven't even read all of your book. That's not fair. I think that in order for a person to give any sort of a review, they should at least try to read the book. And if you can't read the book, then why go out there and destroy a writer's reputation if you didn't give it an honest review? Because so let's face it, if you don't finish a product or use a product the way it's supposed to or give it time, then it's just not honest.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I got a 1-star review on Black Magic's Prey the day it came out. I'm like, I know you didn't read this book. I know you didn't. Now, luckily, that was on Goodreads and not on Amazon. So I don't know who it was, but I'm like, yeah, you could not possibly have read my book. It came out today. So sometimes people are just weird. But there have been books that I gave a 1-star to, but I left a review and I said, okay, did not finish, and I didn't finish it for this reason and this reason. Typically, I try not to do that for indies, though. I'll be honest. Like you said, you didn't get any 3-star reviews. If I'm dealing with an indie, if I can't give it a 4 or 5-star, often I won't leave a review because I do, like you said, I don't want to ruin an author's reputation. Just because it wasn't for me doesn't mean that it's not for everybody. So I think a lot in the indie community or people who read indies, like they understand how much more weight their reviews have than, you know, for Stephen King. It's like no one cares that there's 1-stars for Stephen King. So, yeah, I try to be respectful of that and think about their platform. And if you're just starting out, you know, there's no reason to trash a fellow author. It's like, you know, if you feel that strongly about them, just send them an email or a DM on Facebook or something.
Right. How many stars would you give Sunder in Time?
I feel comfortable giving it a solid 4.
Yeah, it's interesting. And, when we ask authors to review their own book, what they would give them, I don't think I've run into anybody yet, and I've asked this question several times on this program and off the air also, and very, very few of them will give their book a 5-star. But I think, I think a 4-star, 3-star or 4-star is usually the response that I usually get.
Yeah, because like 5-star just knocks you out of the park. And honestly, I don't know if you can ever give your own work a 5-star, because part of that 5-star, 10 out of 10 recommend, part of that comes from, I think, just being surprised by the emotional impact of it. And I think you can only get that from other people's work.
Exactly. I also understand that you're an editor. How does that work for you?
That works fantastic. That's actually how I finance my writing. I edit mostly what pays the bills is dissertations, because those are just all year round. But then I also usually get between 1 and 2 novels or memoirs a month. And those are just, they're great. I love working with people. And now that I'm kind of off on my own, I take work exclusively through Fiverr Pro. I'm not with my agency anymore. I get to choose who I work with, and it's just so great because I get to focus more on, you know, sci-fi and fantasy instead of, you know, self-help, which I never really liked. And I'm definitely loving memoirs, because a lot of times memoirists just make the same kind of mistakes right off the bat. They structure it like an autobiography, and I help them structure it like a novel. So it's really rewarding work, and I just love it. I wouldn't want to quit.
How long have you been doing that?
Oh, goodness, 11 years now. Been off on my own. I've been doing it in my day job as well for about 15, but just, you know, on a freelance capacity for 11 years.
Very good, very good. And give another plug for your, what's the name of your editing company?
The Nonsense Free Editor.
Okay.
Yes,
so,
and we also, I just started up a community called the Nonsense Free Novelist, because, you know, I think I'm like a lot of people. I'm getting kind of sick of social media and the ads and the ugliness. And so I moved over to my own network. And that's just going really great. We're still growing, but everybody's positive. They want to talk about their writing. They want to, you know, share videos and tips. And it was the best choice I've ever made. I'm really happy to be over there.
Very good. When you're not writing, what do you like to do in your free time or editing?
Oh, I'm kind of a TV junkie. Like if I'm not writing or editing, I am parked in front of the TV, either watching YouTube or watching Family Guy reruns. And now, you know, we've got such great Star Wars and Marvel shows. I'm watching those too. So WandaVision, you know, Falcon and the Winter Soldier just came out. Yeah. So I spent a lot of time on Disney Plus.
Yeah, that's great. You know, I do a lot of that binge watching too, especially during the pandemic here in the last year.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of TV going on in my house. Okay, do you use an outline in plotting your stories, or does it free flow from your mind?
A little of both. I always create an outline, and then I usually get about halfway through, and then the story kind of takes me its own way. So I can't really get started without an outline to know where I'm going, but you know, I understand that I'm going to kind of diverge from what I plot out, and then the book is usually better for it.
Uh-huh. And so you do a little bit of both, which is good, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. What's next for Kristen McTiernan?
Next, I'm working on a course actually for memoir writers, since I've got a day job and a side hustle. I do not have the time to coach people. So I figured I'll just make a course. But once that's done, then I'm going to be writing my short story about the nun, which is going to kind of be the entry point into my Black Magic series. And then once that's done, then I'm going to write book three of the Mason Timeline trilogy, which I'm so excited about.
Uh-huh. Great. Do you have a favorite memoir that you've read?
I do, but I don't know if it counts as a memoir.
Uh-huh.
Norm Macdonald of SNL fame wrote based on a true story. And it's like a fictionalized, highly not real version of his life. And it's so hysterically funny. So I don't know if it counts, but I really like that. And then I would say a close second is Andrew Clavin's The Great Good Thing, which was just full of heart and good life advice. And you just really like felt who he was through the memoir. So I thought that was very well done.
Did you ever read Angela's Ashes?
I didn't, because reading the back blurb in itself made me sad. So I was like, I'm not going to read this.
And as far as writing a memoir, what is your, I mean, I've heard negative and I've heard positive about memoirs, about especially somebody that's not famous when they write their memoir. What would make a memoir something that's readable to somebody that doesn't know the person that it's talking about?
Well, the most important thing is to pick a theme, because they don't know who you are. So they're not being like, oh, well, I'm going to read about Tom Riddle. No. So they want to read about, oh, okay, this is a guy who had a gangster granddaddy who went to jail. You want to have that theme, and then select the bits and pieces of your life that go along with that theme and include those. The worst thing you can do is just bore people with bits of your life that have nothing to do with anything, because they don't really care about you, because they don't know you.
Right.
So you want to pick that theme, and that's what you're writing about. And then if something, just because something happened in your life that's important to you, if it doesn't have anything to do with the theme of your memoir, don't include it.
Right, right. The reason I ask is I wrote a memoir back in 2009. It was 700 pages long, but it was written more for myself than it was to be mass-produced or published to an, you know, a great audience. It was more for me. I took some journal entries and I put them all in a memoir, and I knew that it was important. So I think that there's those kind of writers out there also that aren't really looking for an audience that goes beyond family and friends. If they're trying to put something out there or compile an event in their life that meant a lot to them, that maybe their family or friends might know. So there, I guess there's another avenue to take a memoir down. Would you agree with that?
Oh, that's actually the majority. Most people who send me their memoirs, you know, they specify up front, you know, I'm not doing this to be published. I'm doing this because my kids have never known me as anything but their mom. And I just want them to know who I am. And so if you're publishing for family, that's a whole other animal, because then you want them to know, oh, well, here's the list of people who were kind to me, and here's my friends who held you as a baby, and you don't remember them, but here's who they were. That's a whole other animal. Yeah, if you're doing a commercial memoir, the standards for that are much higher. You know, you have to entertain people, you have to hook them right off the bat. But if you're dealing only with readers who already know who you are and are invested in you, yeah, I mean, you don't have to do the whole song and dance, because they actually want to know the nitty-gritty about your life.
Right, right. What writing advice would you give to young authors out there?
Study, study, study. I get very frustrated with these internet entrepreneurs who like pump out these YouTubes like, you can make $5 million by publishing on KDP.
Yeah.
And they just encourage you to just pump out crap. And it irritates me. You know, these people, they pay me money to edit their stuff, but it's just like, you don't even read. I can tell you don't read recreationally. You know nothing about the genre, and you're doing this as a get rich quick scheme. Of course, you and I are authors. We know it's not that. You're not getting
right.
rich off of this. So I would say study, read modern bestsellers in your genre. The worst thing you can do is, you know, reread the stuff that was cool when you were an adolescent, because genres change very, very quickly. You know, if you read something that was published 50 years ago, the prose is different, the characters are different, the plot arcs are different, sensibilities change. So read modern bestsellers in the genre that you want to publish in, and also take note of genres. A lot of people think that they're writing fantasy. It's like, no, you're writing paranormal, which is a subset of fantasy, but it has a set of very specific requirements that your readers are going to expect. And if you don't know what those requirements are, if you don't know the tropes of your subgenre, it's going to be tough to target the right readers who are going to be invested in your book. So reading within your genre is very, very important. And then, of course, writing. Even if nobody ever sees it, you know, just writing in and of itself is going to teach you. And go to critique groups, because those are generally free. Or if they cost money, it's very little money. It's like $5 a month or something like that. Do that, because the feedback that you're going to get from other writers will be invaluable. And you want to get that feedback before it's time to plonk down a cool grand on an editor.
Right. Yeah, that's a very anxiety-provoking situation, especially when you're going to ask somebody to critique your work. There's a lot of people
mm-hmm.
who would shy away from that, but it's something that that you need to move on and get over that. Some people never get over it, the anxiety of their work and how they feel about it. We're talking about, you know, 4 or 5 stars for your own work. Some people wouldn't give their work 2 or 3 stars. Mm-hmm. And to go to a critique, if you feel that way, it's probably not going to make you feel much better when you leave it, but at the same time, if you think of it positively, you come away with a better knowledge, and you learn from it like everything else in life. Things are bad, and you learn from it, and you move on, and you get better from it. So,
yeah, I'm not sure where we got this idea that writing is just something you're born with, and you either have talent or you don't. It's a skill. You know, it doesn't matter what you're born with. It matters the time you put into it, because even a prolific reader who you know, is great at English classes and things like that, if they've never written a work of fiction, if they've only done their, you know, essay assignments in school, that's a totally different skill. And it takes time to develop those fiction muscles where you have the satisfying plot arc and the satisfying character arc and realistic dialogue, which is such a trip up point for so many people.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why. Well, actually, I do. It's because we all grew up watching Murder, She Wrote with schlocky, horrible dialogue. And that's what comes out in our writing when we first get started. You know, and it takes practice to get rid of that.
Yeah, dialogue is very interesting, and it's a study in itself, and a lot of people don't even take the time to study it. And if they did study it, I think they'd come away with a gem that I think it would really help their writing a lot.
Definitely. Like with dialogue in particular, you have the characters calling one another by their name in every line. Like, how often do you call, you know, the person you're speaking to by their name? Never. Ever. So why do you have it in every line of dialogue? That's so common.
Right. Boy, that's it's good that you're an editor. It's good that you're an author. You've certainly been through the wars in your life with the nunnery and the you know, being in the service and everything. And thank you for serving our country. It's a pleasure to know you. And like I say, I've seen you around on the internet, as they say, and really appreciate your work. You've done a good job, and I wish you nothing but the best here as we get down to the last, I think, 8 minutes of the show. But where can readers go and find you and your books? Of course, everybody knows, you know, you go to Amazon, but where else can they find you if they want to know more about you and what you do for writers and your authoring of your books and your editing, of course?
Well, my author page is kristenmctiernan.com, and that's kind of where I keep my nerdy blogs. And then going to the Nonsense Free Novelist, and I don't have the web address of that because that's hosted by Mighty Networks. That's actually the network to find me on. And there's a free option if you don't want to be in the critique group. So it's just like Facebook. You just log on. It's free. And we talk some writing and give tips and support and talk about what we're working on at the moment. And that's pretty much the best place to find me. I am also on Facebook, but I don't check in on there as much as I used to.
Very good. We'd love to have you back on someday, maybe talk a little bit more about editing, because I know that there's a lot of writers that are out there listening into the show that would like some advice from you, and maybe you can help along those roads. And again, thank you. Your book was wonderful. I look to read more from you when I have time. I'm reading probably 5 books a month right now I'm at, and I will pick up another one of your books. But thank you for being on the Writer's Lounge.
Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed it, and I would love to come back.
Very good, Kristen. Thank you very much. Have a good night now.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye. So there is Kristen McTiernan, and she wrote Sunder of Time. And again, it was wonderful having her on the show to talk time travel. And let's talk about the final chapter, as we do here after we leave our authors. Today, we talk to Kristen, and next time around, in 2 weeks, on April 5th, we're going to have Mandy Dalrymple, and she wrote The Sense of Death. It's a murder mystery blended with a paranormal twist, and that is always a good recipe to hook a reader into flipping the pages. I look forward to having Mandy Dalrymple as a guest on the Writer's Lounge. And until next time, if you are an author or reader, open up that book and let the story begin. See you next time on the Writer's Lounge.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface on simple secret of the plot. It's just to tell you that I love you a lot.